The Summit County Council met last night and discussed the details about Public Lands Initiative and canyons. On the phone to tell us about it is Council Member Doug Clyde. Welcome, Doug. How are you?
Good morning. Fine, thank you.
Good. So you weren't around on council when the county went through the PLI effort, but you said that it seemed like the rug was pulled out from under the county on the plan. Tell me about that.
Well, I only have the data that was presented to me, but it seemed like we worked very hard to try and come to a cooperative agreement with the senator, and the end result was that we didn't the end result was that the bill was much different than what we thought was agreed upon.
So why did you join your colleagues in supporting an effort by Summit County to go it alone?
Simply because, our options are strictly limited. We can either join the bill that was presented to us, or the effort that was presented to us by the senator. And that obviously proved to be futile in the last effort, or we can attempt to have our voice heard in a separate bill.
So go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so we wanted to make our voices heard separately because we were afraid we were going to get lost, and again, perhaps dispersed or even perhaps lost in the existing bill.
Okay. Are you for the Keep Public Lands in Public Hands effort, and if so, why?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that completely. Am I for what?
The Keep Public Lands in Public Hands effort.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I think we all are.
Can you go into why?
Well, I think the reasons are obvious. The lands belong to the federal government. The federal government administers those lands in a way that is beneficial to all the citizens of the United States, not just the select few of Utah. And those are widely appropriate and popular issues for us in general.
Do you think the county will have an impact over the debate on Bears Ears?
Well, relative to the voice of Utah, no, I don't think that we will have a significant impact. We'll do our best. We will make our voices heard, but will we turn the tide of the legislature? No, of course not.
Okay. There was also discussion on the agenda of the county resource management plan. The state is requiring all counties to come up with a plan to manage their public lands. Roger Armstrong said, he kind of wondered, is this a plan the state wants to institute, or if it takes over federal lands? What do you think?
Well, it's the legislation in and of itself is problematic. That is to say, it's generated by the intent or the desire of the state to take over public lands. Whether that'll happen or not is a conversation that's completely beyond our control. We produced the bill. We produced the ordinance and did so with the full faith and understanding that it was our obligation to do so. And I think that the work product that we produced was appropriate, but it will only become effective to the extent that we actually end up receiving federal lands. That is something that's completely out of our control.
Okay. Moving on, you made a remark in passing to the effect that the Forest Service doesn't know the difference between proper forest management and a hot rock. What did you mean by that?
Well, we had a speaker who had come down from Wyoming who had participated with us in previous negotiations on this issue. And he had made a similar statement, and I've had many years of dealing with the Forest Service, and I do a lot of work in forest management in an attempt to manage both forest health and forest quality, and especially fire management, which is the big issue. And I was simply supporting him. That man had driven a long ways to come and make his remark, and I was simply supporting him in his comment.
Okay. So moving on to canyons, explain mm-hmm. something. You saw these plans for the assessment district and plans to build workforce housing, but all of this can't happen unless the resort gets an approval for its amended master plan and in front of Snyderville Planning Commission. So why is this coming to you now?
Well, it's a very complicated scenario. As you noted correctly, we have to get a proposal sent up from the Planning Commission to amend the master plan, first of all, to allow it to happen. But it also is a statutory requirement based on their development agreement with the county. Their development agreement with the county requires that they produce an affordable housing plan and then determine how that's going to be executed. So all these things are happening simultaneously. So we're looking at that. We've been in contact with them for some time, staff has, and of course we have as well, in terms of what they are proposing from an affordable housing point of view. We have been in negotiations for some time. What they're proposing right now, we believe to be substantially greater perhaps than what they might nominally be required under a strict legal interpretation of the development agreement. So that's why we're looking at it.
So County Attorney Dave Thomas said to realize its plan, the resort has to formulate four agreements with the county. Can you explain what those are?
Well, they're complicated. They're agreements that, first of all, we have to agree on a plan. That is to say, what is it that we are accepting as being an appropriate agreement? Then we have to set in motion an agreement for them to maintain the items that are being bonded for. Those include the roads and the affordable housing. Then we have to execute an agreement with Vail, requiring them to use a remote park and ride. And then we have to enter into an agreement to initiate paid parking within the canyons so that people are disincentivized to drive to the canyons, that they're incentivized to use remote parking or transportation to get to the canyons, which is one of our big objectives. Those are complicated, extremely complicated agreements.
Okay. All right. Well, that's our time. Is there anything you want to add before we go?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde. When we come back, we'll talk to the Kids Adventure Games founder, Billy Madison. We'll be back in a moment. KPCW time is 8:31. You're listening to KPCW's The Local News Hour. And in studio, we have Kid Adventure Games founder, Billy Madison. And we also have advocate Alicia Nicewander. Right? Did I say it right?
Alicia, but that's okay.
Alicia, okay. That's well, I got
right.
the last name
you
right.
You did. Thanks.
One of them. All right. So we have the games coming June 16th through 18th. How long have you been doing this?
We've been putting these games on in Vail since, this will be our 10th season in Vail, but going across the country, this will be our fourth year doing that. And it's our first time coming to Park City.
Oh, this is, I thought you were here last year.
We were at the Olympic Training Center last year.
Okay.
So we've moved the venue over to Park City this year.
So you have 9 events nationwide.
We do. Yeah. We go from Vermont, Stowe, Vermont, to Big Bear, California, a lot of places in between.
Those are my old stomping grounds, Big Bear, California. Yeah. So how did you get this started? I understand you were kind of an adventurer yourself.
I adventure raced for 10 years all over the world, had a blast doing it, and finally got old, said that's enough of that. And for my kid's birthday, just on a whim, one morning I took a bunch of stumps. I've been chopping wood for the fireplace and set the stumps up, put a ladder between the stumps and tied some ropes in the trees. And, the kids were only 3-4 years old. And they just kept doing laps on it, loved it. The parents loved it. And that grew. And the parents were like, you got to take this to the rec district. And we did. And it's been growing ever since.
So, Alicia, what are the ages of kids that can participate?
It starts at age 6 and it goes up through age 14. So it's teams of 2. It can be boy, boy, girl, girl, boy, girl. Different age categories can go together. An 8-year-old can race with a 12-year-old. If that's the case, they would race up. So they would race in the 12-year-old age division. But it really provides a good opportunity for a lot of different age kids to get out there and have some fun.
And what if you don't have a team? What if you are flying solo? Can you still participate?
I don't know how that works.
You need a partner. Safety reasons, we like them having partners, and the teamwork is a big part of what we do. So we would be happy to, we have a bunch of solo kids to match them up and, do our best to find them a partner.
Okay. So I'm told that the course is spectator friendly and fun for the whole family. How so?
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually, because part of our deal is letting the kids figure it out themselves, and it's a double-edged sword. We want the parents; they're paying for the kids. They seem to enjoy it more than the kids a lot of times, but we don't want the parents coaching them. We want them cheering them on, and they're able to be in certain spots on the course to cheer them on. But what we don't want them is them guiding them through the course and helping them. We want the kids to be able, try to figure these obstacles and routes out on their own. So yeah, it is you can spectator friendly, but we like to keep the parents at a distance.
So you've been doing this for a little while. I understand you have 300 teams. Is that nationwide? 300 teams or? Just for Park City.
That's just Park City. Yeah.
Wow. So if it's teams of 2, that's 600 kids.
Yeah.
So 300 teams is where we sell out. We're not quite there yet, but we're on our way. Registration has been open since, I believe, the beginning of March. And so we've had a lot of interest from kids that did it last year and kids that heard about it late and they couldn't sign up anymore or after the fact heard what a great event it was. So really, if you're going to be around and you're interested, definitely sign up because most likely it will sell out.
So what are the benefits for the kids? What have you seen in terms of when they first get there to afterwards?
These courses are hard. It's not an easy course, and we do that intentionally. They're about 3 miles long. They'll usually have 200 to 300 feet of vertical gain in it. And I think a sense of accomplishment at the end. They're really proud. The parents are even prouder than the kids are. The kids pretty much go right back to normal at the end. But, you know, having to work together, the teamwork thing, we really push that. And, you know, they and fun, you know, they that's the next down the line is just having fun doing it. And I think we do a good job of accomplishing that.
So it takes about an hour and a half to finish the course. How long should people plan for this?
It depends on the team. You know, these mountain towns that we go to have really outstanding athletic kids that kind of blow us away. We think we've come up with a really hard course, and these kids come in and smoke it. And so, yeah, hour and a half. And then there are kids that, you know, do kind of stop and smell the roses along the way. You know, we make them bring a little snack and stuff, and they'll sit down in the course. Some kids will eat their snack and then get going again, you know, which is fine.
So how many staff members are there to pull this off, to set it up, and do you need volunteers for it?
We definitely need volunteers. That's a huge component of this race series. The volunteers, I was just talking to Ethel about it out there. We need people to help with parking, people to help with the bike corral, people to help with transitions, people to man the obstacles. It's really a big community effort to pull this off, and even the volunteers have a blast. And we've got an amazing opportunity raffle as well, where we've gotten a lot of prizes from local businesses and also some national companies that we will essentially raffle off for the volunteers to say thank you for giving back.
So how many kids participated last year over at the Olympic?
I think last year, I want to say we had about 190 teams total. And then we also have, on Friday, we have a skills clinic day, which is where kids can come over and they can register and get their little race bags. And then they can also sign up for a skills clinic. And we had some extra kids that just did that part as well, where they can do mountain bike specific things and learn about fixing their bike and riding switchbacks and that sort of thing to help develop those skills.
So I watched the video on the website. Some of this stuff looks kind of perilous, you know, the floaties on water that you're running across and climbing things and jumping from one area to another. What can people look forward to at the Park City Mountain Resort where it's being held this year?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I haven't been there yet. I'm meeting this afternoon with the Park City guys to kind of come up with a rough course. But ideally, you know, the slip and slide is our signature event. We have a really good setup where, you know, we can set up a, you know, 100-yard long slip and slide that goes into a big deep pool. We set up Tyrolean traverses and zip lines, slack lines over mud pits, hiking. We'd have a blow dart gun hunt. We do a water balloon launch where one team can launch water balloons at the teams coming up behind them. I love that as a kid, and you know, I think most kids do. Bike riding, hiking, and they have to navigate their way through the course. We give them a map at the beginning, and I do a talk with each age group before they leave, and you know, really tell it the way it is. It's, you know, this is real. This is not. It's a true adventure. It's not a Ferris wheel that they're getting on and going to come right back to where they started from, but they're going to have to figure it out. And so it's – and anything we can come up with. If there's any sort of natural thing too, like if a tree has fallen down, we'll maybe take off the branches and make that a big balance beam. If there's a swamp that we can get them to hike through, we love that. The kids love that. You know, so we just look at each venue and see what we can come up with.
I think you should do a bonus day for adults.
Every parent adult says that. And boy,
so when?
Well, we have a race in Copper Mountain in Colorado where the parents and the child can do it together. And it's funny, we did it last year and the kids did way better than the parents. There was a bunch of mothers that just did not want to run those pads across the cold water lake that the kids didn't seem to have a problem with.
Yeah, I think if I have a helmet, I'll be okay. But I don't want to race. I just want to do it.
It's for fun.
I'll be like 5 hours, but I want to do it.
And that's a big piece of it, too. It's an adventure race, but it's also about fun and just getting the kids out there and trying something different. There's this nervous energy at the beginning of everything like this. But once the kids get on course and that gun goes off and they're working with their teammate, it's all about fun. And it's really just about accomplishing something and getting confidence in the outdoors, working with your buddy.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That's our time. Is there anything you want to... Oh, how can people get more information and register? Is there a number or...
You can register at kidsadventuregames.com. And if anybody is interested that's hearing this in volunteering, you can contact me directly. I'll leave my number here at the station, but also my phone number is 435-640-2979.
All right.
So come on out. It'll be fun.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Really appreciate it. That was Ambassador, not Advocate, Ambassador Alicia Nicewander and founder Billy Madison. Thank you so much for joining us. According to a survey included in a 2015 article published by the Journal of Emergency Medical Services, more than 4,000 first responders, that's 6.6%, had attempted suicide, which is more than 10 times the rate of the general population. In studio to talk about what is being done to protect Park City first responders is Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So in 2017, in February, we lost Captain Kurt Peterson. He took his life. And that was a huge wake-up call for everyone. I know that he had been talking about the need for mental health care himself. And there's also in the culture the stigma of first responders, firefighters, to be tough, to not show emotion, you know.
Right.
How true is that, and what is being done to change that culture, that mindset?
Yeah, I think it's very true. First of all, I have to say that this has been an issue for decades, and the fire service has made a lot of strides over the last couple of decades. There's an organization that's actually the Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance. They have a website and they track firefighter suicides. In the last 5 years, they're just coming up to the number of 1,000 firefighter suicides in the last 5 years. And it, you know, if you look at the issue of suicide in our culture and here in America, it's at its highest rate over the last 30 years. We're peaking and we're really trying to get our hands around this. But prior to this incident and the suicide in our own fire district, we had quite a few resources available. We have an employee assistance program. The state has firefighter crisis hotlines that they can call. There's also national suicide hotlines, of course, and they have statewide critical incident stress debriefings. And in Park City last year, Park City Fire, we started some mental health awareness training, also through a gentleman here in the state, Jordan Peterson, that's very astute at doing this. We had our second part of that training this year. But like you said, we want to make sure that we're doing everything, and that's an area that we absolutely want to be ahead of the curve on. Here in Park City, we're very good about monitoring their physical health. And I think we can make some big strides in monitoring their mental health. So what we've done is we are looking at the firefighter's career from the day that they get hired. We have them, we just hired a class of six that are in recruit training right now. And they met with a clinical psychiatrist to make sure that they have the makeup of a firefighter mentally so that they can adapt and that they handle the types of things they're going to see in their career well. So that's the first step. And then we're working with the University of Utah Neurological Institute to help us develop an assessment tool. We're not the first to do that. Tucson, Arizona had a couple of major issues in their fire district or fire department, just like we recently had. And they're looking at doing an annual assessment tool, too, just to find out if there's any suicidal ideation or if they're having issues and thoughts that would lead them down that road so that there can be some intervention and process. So we'll continue our mental health awareness training. We're as you can well imagine, we've had a lot of well-wishers and people that want to help, and we're taking advantage of a lot of them. Summit County Health reached out to us, and next week we're sending several firefighters through some question, persuade, response training. They're going to be trained, the trainers, so they can train all of us. We're instituting an SOG, and you're right. When you said that firefighters are tough and they don't want to reach out, you know, there's all kinds of resources. But we want to make sure that we give them a full menu of what they, because what may work for someone might not work for another, right? So we're instituting this standard operating guideline that now says if they see a child die or if they see some traumatic event, a coworker, or a multi-casualty incident, that it's now their supervisor's responsibility to, and it will become automatic, that they will go into a critical incident stress debriefing of sorts. We're also instituting 12 of our members are going to a peer support class next week, and we'll have a peer support group. So that'll be another way that they can reach out. And we're working with the University of Utah, again, the Neurologic Institute, to look at embedding a clinical psychiatrist here in Park City. So those are some of the things that we're looking at doing. But we're really trying to corral. Again, we've had dozens and dozens of people that want to help us and have resources at hand. And we're trying to make sure that we have a process that makes sense for the district as well.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear about the outreach after this. Because Parkites, the longer I'm here, the more I become aware of how involved they are, how much they care. Mm-hmm. So on a, you know, resident level, individual community member, is there anything they can do to, if they wanted to get involved, if they wanted to show support or do something, is there anything that they can do? Or,
well, we have a, you know, firefighters are a brotherhood. There's roughly 40,000 fire departments nationwide. We're all connected at the hip. And I think the most active group, I shouldn't say that, there's a lot of active groups on this issue, right? And it's mental health. It's not just firefighters. It's around the nation, right? But the Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance, they have a website called ffbha.org, and they do take donations that help very holistically. As far as your local firefighters here, we will, and I've been in contact with the people that are the most knowledgeable on this topic. And our program as it stands now and the way that it's set up, it is an area that I want to be second to none on. I don't make any bones about that. I want to make sure that we are the leaders in this, and that's the wake-up call that you referred to. We did have a lot of resources prior. We're going to have a lot more now. And they will have a full menu to select from. Our firefighters will. There's nobody in our district that wants to, if this ever happened again, we never, and you know, heaven forbid it ever does, but I want to be able to say, and everybody here, every one of our citizens want to be able to say that we've done everything possible. And that's exactly where we're headed.
Well, I know when I came to your office, you had a couple of your first responders there to talk with me. And I remember one of them asked if they could ask me a question, because that's my job. I do all the questions. And he asked me, out of everything he could have asked me, he said, "What are you hearing out there in the field? Is there something we can do better?" It was really important to him to know that you guys are doing everything you can to serve your community. And that's just speaks a lot to the men and women who are working with you in the district. What is there anything that we aren't aware of, or anything that the community should know about the firefighters here, the first responders? And like you said, we already have Connect and the mental health awareness and all these other things. But is there something that
I think our good question. I think our firefighters would think I was remiss if I didn't tell you that our firefighters are amazing. I know all of them very well, very individually and very well, and we have amazing firefighters, very strong individuals. And typically, firefighters are that way. They love working here, and the public treats them exceptionally well. And if you could take any of our firefighters and sit them down here, and you could tell that they work in an area where they are very well appreciated, and we much appreciate the support. I totally do. We work in a resort town, and they get out among our community. You'd be hard-pressed to find a fire organization that is as involved in the community as ours is. They love that support. They love being part of the community. You'll see them all the time. They'll go out and have lunches in the restaurants. I encourage them to do that and to interact. And I think the community's always been extremely supportive of the fire district. We get it every day, day in and day out. So if I had those two that you met with, and you got to see what exceptional firefighters we have, both in attitude and abilities, they just love working here. So the community here has just been amazing and continue to be amazing.
Maybe we should have a Hug a Firefighter Day.
You know what? It's every day, right?
That's right.
They will absolutely hug you, me included.
Okay. Well, is there anything you'd like to add before we go?
Just be careful out there. It's still icy. It was a hard freeze last night, down to 21 degrees. Be careful. There's ice on some spots, and here we go. It'll warm up.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Chief Paul Hewitt. When we come back, we're going to be talking to e-bike advocate Charlie Gandy. You're listening to The Local News. E-bike advocacy advisor Charlie Gandy. Welcome, Charlie. How are you doing?
I'm doing great this morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I understand you're in Salt Lake City getting ready for the big convention that's going to be happening.
We're hosting the Electric Bike Expo at Smith's Field Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, giving free e-bike rides to anybody who wants to show up to learn about this amazing new thing. And all the local e-bike dealers are participating. And, yeah, it's free, and we're throwing a party at Smith's Field this weekend.
So Park City is leading the way for the nation with their e-bike program. Can you tell me about that and why it's important?
Well, let me tell you, yeah, when we started the research on Salt Lake City and deciding to move or to bring the expo here, not only did we look at, you know, logistics, but we also looked at the culture. And that's where I learned that Park City was embracing electric bikes as part of a bike share program. And then when I learned that, in fact, it would be the first city in the United States to have a complete electric bike share system, that perked my attention. That made me extend my trip a day to go up to Park City and to take an e-bike up there and to ride around and to talk to Julia Collins with the city and others about how that process happened and where they were going with it. Because in my business, I'll stop there, but there's more to that story.
Okay. Well, can you tell our listeners what's the difference between an e-bike and a moped? I know that there's some confusion sometimes.
You know, there are lots of different varieties, but I can boil it down to this. An electric bike, the ones that we have at the expo are pedal assist, meaning that you have to pedal them to go anywhere. It's like having an additional set of gears on a bicycle. It gives you mechanical leverage moving forward. And so on all but a couple of them, they don't have throttles. And so if you're going to, what you do when you put a pound of pressure on that pedal is that you get a pound of support back from the electric motor. And it's like eagles or angels under your pedals as you go along. And that's just on the flats. Don't get me started about how easy it is to go up hills. I went up Guardsman Pass while I was at your place, and I never used the maximum power, the turbo gear on that electric bike that I had. It was a Trek Powerfly, state-of-the-art bike, and it just took me, as a 58-year-old aging athlete, it took me right up that pass. It took me up that pass, and I'll stop there because there's also another story about coming down.
You have a lot of stories that you're stopping. Why don't you go ahead and finish this one?
You know what? As I mentioned, I'm 58 years old, and so when I turned that bike around and came back down, I turned the power off. I turned the power on, kept it on just so I could read my speed. But I didn't have any power assist. I didn't need any. I was coasting, and I got up to 47 miles per hour riding down that pass, Guardsman Pass. And I noticed that the speed limit at one point was 40 miles per hour, and I started slowing down. It was the most exhilarating thing I've done in a long time to come off that pass. And that was actually the insight about electric bikes, and that is, I could have on a regular road bike ridden up that pass, but it would have been a killer climb. With this e-bike, I was able to climb up that hill and have that exhilarating ride back down and live to talk about it.
Well, I know that Park City is going to have 88 bikes in their program. It's starting in June. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go, Charlie?
Well, I'm in the business of sounding out creative communities in my career as a bike consultant in Long Beach, California. And so I look for charisma in places, and the charisma of San Francisco or Austin, Texas, is about them doing something different and inviting others in to see it. And what you're doing with this electric bike share is a similar type of charisma that you have to add to the personality of Park City. And that's why it's a smart economic development move on your part, and that's why I'm talking about it.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and talking to us about it. That is Charlie Gandy at eBike Advocacy Advisor. We'll be back in a moment.